Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host. Today, I'm in conversation with Sterling Higa, an incredible activist who, with an equally incredible coalition, is making real difference for housing affordability in Hawaii. Sterling co-founded and serves as executive director of Housing Hawaii's Future, a nonprofit movement creating opportunities for Hawaii's next generation by ending the workforce housing shortage. Prior to co-founding Housing Hawaii's Future, Sterling was a lecturer at Hawaii Pacific University and a writer for Honolulu Civil Beat and Hawaii Business Magazine. He currently lives in Honolulu with his wife and four children. There's a lot to learn from Sterling here, and you might think advocacy in Hawaii is like categorically different from where you are. In some ways, that may be true, but in more ways, I think you'll find a lot in common. Take Hawaii's deep blue legislature, for example. Some of us in deeply divided legislatures might imagine this makes it easier to get something across the finish line, like you just win over one party and boom, done. But that's not the case, in ways that make the process arguably even more complicated by loosening the cohesion between party affiliation and ideology. But that's just one easy example. You'll hear nuanced context for advocating for more homes, but the arguments for those opposed to unlocking more homes in our communities remain formally the same all too often. Despite the many challenges that would have deterred less determined advocates, Sterling and the Housing Abundance Coalition in Hawaii got great things done in 2023, and he shares them with us on this episode. So let's jump in and hear how. Well, hey, Sterling, thanks so much for coming on The Stoop.
Awesome. Thank you for having me, Cutter.
Yeah, let's jump right in. I want to know what your housing story is. What is it that made you curious, excited, passionate about this issue as a matter of public policy in the first place?
I grew up in Hawaii, in Honolulu, the major city on the island of Oahu. Public school graduate and have worked here pretty much all of my career. A few years ago, about 4 years ago, I was approached by Zachary Amata and Evan Gates, two of the co-founders of Housing Hawaii's Future. And Zach was a recent college graduate, and Evan was a college student taking a gap year during the pandemic. And they were concerned about the trajectory of housing prices. They calculated correctly that at the current rate of increasing housing prices, an increasing proportion of upper middle class people would be priced out of home ownership in Hawaii. And they said that if we didn't organize young people now to get civically engaged and address the housing issue, by the time Zach and Evan were done with college and starting their careers, you know, they wouldn't have a Hawaii to come home to. And so when confronted with these two young men who had this idea to found Housing Hawaii's Future, I couldn't say no. A bit after that, about a year after founding Housing Hawaii's Future, I got married. And so my wife and I have four children, three from her previous marriage. So the older kids now are 14, 13, and 10. And our baby is a year and a half old. So every morning when I wake up, like this morning, and I look at our kids, I think, God, I hope they can have a buddy to call from when they're older and when they're old enough to have kids.
Yeah, that seems like a huge part of your why, the thing that keeps you motivated in this space. And I think that's true all over the place, but Hawaii seems to have a really strong sense of that multi-generational kind of need, right? I mean, I remember that coming out in the campaign. We worked together a fair amount when it was all in process. And that seemed to be one of the sticking points, is that a lot of folks were unable to come home after they had been away, or were being priced out and having to move elsewhere. Is that right?
Yes. In Hawaii right now, more than half of all Native Hawaiians live outside of the state of Hawaii.
Wow.
Which sort of indicates an exodus. Longtime local families like mine, I'm fifth generation Japanese. Many longtime local families are also leaving. And the cost of housing it's not the only driver of that, but in my opinion, it's the most significant driver. For a lot of families, they reach a certain point where in any normal housing market, they'd be able to afford home ownership, and there's no opportunity here in Hawaii. And then they go on Zillow for Las Vegas or Eastern Washington, and they're able to find homes immediately that they can afford. And given those opportunities, both job wise and housing, it's hard to convince a lot of people to stay in Hawaii where they know that they'll be struggling for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. I want to jump into all that stuff about how we do that in a bit. But there's so much story to tell in between that. And let's just start from the top. I guess, like, top level, what did your coalition accomplish in the recent session? Because there were several things, right?
We worked with a coalition of other housing advocates this session to pass two key pieces of legislation at the state level in Hawaii. Hawaii has a state legislature and only four major counties, so we're a very small state, and so the state is very important. The first law we passed was SB 3202. That bill will allow for the construction of two accessory dwelling units on most residentially zoned lots. And that overrides any county law otherwise. The second law we passed was HB 2090, and HB 2090 does two things. The first is it adds multifamily residential zoning to all commercially zoned property in the state of Hawaii. And the second thing it does is it makes it easier to do adaptive reuse by requiring that counties follow, international building codes for adaptive reuse. Essentially, that law changes only Honolulu's building code. Honolulu was very restrictive in what it permitted in terms of ventilation and natural lighting. And those restrictions were preventing the conversion from a lot of old commercial buildings into residences.
Okay, and that's essentially the meaning of adaptive reuse there, right? It's like there's an existing building that's
Exactly.
okay. You're adapting it for some kind of new use.
Yeah, and in Honolulu, for perspective, we have a downtown sort of central business district, which has a lot of high-rise office buildings. And those office buildings have very high vacancy rates, especially following the pandemic. So there has been a big push to take some of these office buildings and convert them into residential towers. But that has run aground with some of Honolulu's building code issues around ventilation and natural lighting, which are more stringent than the international building code.
Yeah, and that seems to be an interesting part of a lot of the discussions nationwide about like these local governments have really, really extensive, really granular like policy or regulations that stand in the way of unlocking things that are right there in front of you, right? So much of it is already there. Well, I know that getting these big wins, because those are huge, like accessory dwelling units and adaptive reuse and commercial uses. And in multifamily zones, like those are big things. And it took a village. And I would love for you to talk about what that was like. Like, you were part of a coalition, you were certainly a leader in that coalition. What was it? How did it come to be?
All our success was team effort. So, some of the organizations we worked with were the Holomua Collective. This is a nonprofit that's trying to address broader cost of living issues in Hawaii. And their model is to host convenings of public sector, private sector, nonprofit, and labor leaders. And so they served as sort of like a backbone convener for our coalition. We worked hard to pull in some housing advocacy groups, including our local Yimby Action Chapter, Hawaii Yimby, and also Hawaii Zoning Atlas, which is a subsidiary of the National Zoning Atlas, which maps how restrictive zoning is in different counties nationwide. So we pulled those two organizations in. We were joined by two groups that normally don't work together, the Grassroot Institute, which is a sort of free market think tank in Hawaii. And Hawaii Appleseed, which is a progressive think tank. And so those two members were also part of the coalition. And we received a lot of support from Senator Brian Schatz's office. So Senator Schatz is one of the most prominent Yimby senators in the US Senate. And he took a special interest in these policies because of how severe the housing shortage in Hawaii is. So with that basic coalition, we had probably like eight people core to our effort who were organizing through their various groups to kind of build our movement.
That's quite an ideological span in the room, which is it's interesting because the legislature there is so heavily Democratic controlled, right? Like overwhelmingly, no, I'm in Texas, nothing like what we have here, which is pretty Republican, but still somewhat divided. What is it like navigating that space? Because it feels like if you were to plop down in, Austin during session, maybe appealing to progressives isn't the only thing you could do, and you might assume in Hawaii that that would be, since it's all Democrats, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Like, there seems to be quite a broad range under the Democratic umbrella there.
Sure. So for those who can only see red or blue, Hawaii is the bluest state. All of our congressional delegates are Democrats. Our governor is a Democrat. Democrats have super majorities in both our state house and our state Senate. So if you just look at party affiliation, we are overwhelmingly Democrat. But within that Democratic Party, there is a sort of tension between different factions. Some lean more moderate, some are probably even what we would call like center right, but most are center left. And then there's a small faction of, very progressive left candidates and elected officials. So even though we're blue, there is sort of a fierce ideological divide. There's also a geographic divide in Hawaii. Oahu is the main island in terms of population, but we have three other counties that represent what we call the neighbor islands. And those neighbor islands are smaller in population. They also have different issues than Oahu. And there's a frequent tension between Oahu representatives and neighbor island representatives, especially when it comes to appropriations, right? It's very different. If you put money on one island, that really doesn't help the people on other islands, or at least they feel that way. So even though there is a superficial, unanimous democratic consensus in Hawaii, in practice, there's a lot of disagreement about what policy should be.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like you could just have a we win the Dems and we win kind of strategy, right? If
Exactly.
only it were that simple. You had in the legislature, I mean, there was obviously one your bill champion. Like we have, everybody has champions in any jurisdiction, right? The person who's going to carry the bill. I think your context is one of the most impressive. You have a champion who was championing the issue before he was even in the legislature. And then really work to carry that across the finish line. And that's Representative Luke Evslin. Could you fill us all in on how he came to be in the legislature? Because that's a funny story. And then what that was like in process? Because that's so beautiful and sadly kind of rare.
Yeah. So Representative Evslin is a very humble man, and he doesn't like it when I talk this way about him, but I do think he's sort of a hero. A brief backstory is before he was ever involved in public service, he was a sort of champion canoe paddler, and he was actually involved in a tragic accident where while doing a crossing between islands, he was run over by a
Oh my
boat,
gosh.
which really hurt his back. There was the possibility that he might bleed out in the water that day. But he survived, recovered. He is still paddling today. He helps to run a canoe manufacturing business called Kumano Composites, which makes some of the best racing canoes in the world. Anyway, setting all that aside, after his near-death experience, Luke Evslin got involved in public service first as a county council member of the smallest county, which is Kauai, which has about 75,000 people. Very, very small county, very small island. And while on the Kauai County Council, Luke was very interested in land use, taxation, and in housing, because housing was the number one issue on Kauai as it is on all of the islands. Last year, though, or a year and a half ago, Luke was appointed to fill a vacancy in the State House of Representatives. And I personally was very excited about this because Luke has, in my opinion, one of the best backgrounds in housing policy of anyone in the state. He is the rare legislator who can both read policy, write policy, and explain policy to the general public. So he hits that trifecta. And there was uncertainty when Luke was appointed to the House on whether he would be allowed to chair the House Housing Committee. The former chair of the House Housing Committee had been moved via appointment to the state Senate. And so there was a hole there. It is unusual, if not, it never happens that a freshman legislator is allowed to chair a committee. As far as I know, it has never happened that a legislator who had never won an election was allowed to chair a committee. But that's what happened with Luke Evslin. He was allowed to chair the House Housing Committee. And he has been a ferocious champion, not just for these bills that passed, but for all sort of pro-housing policy in the state of Hawaii. And so we were really lucky that he became the House Housing Chair. We're lucky to have a champion who can write policy, but also explain it to the general public, explain it to other legislators. He's really patient. He takes feedback well. And we're just really lucky to have Luke. He doesn't like it, but he's my hero.
Yeah, he is certainly like a key component of the success there. I mean, it's rarer than people would imagine to find a legislator who actually even understands the housing issue, let alone can understand it, be proactive in advocating for it internally, and speak to the public the way Representative Evslin does. So that's like an incredible gift. And to that very serendipitous journey to become a housing chair is remarkable. I don't know if anybody believes in any higher power, but that's about to make me, you know? That's about as good as higher powers get when it comes to legislative work, I think. And Representative Evslin wasn't the lone legislative force, and I want to dig into some of the weeds on kind of what happened, because there were several peculiarities about how this worked for y'all, right? I think your bills got what was called a triple joint referral, if I'm getting that term right. And that meant that it was referred to three committees, but they would meet jointly. And any single chair of those committees could kill the bills. Is that right?
Exactly. And the triple joint referral can either be one of two things, right? It can be a real boon and help to your bill, or it can mean the kiss of death, because you have to have unanimous consent from your three or two committee chairs, whatever amount of committees your bill is referred to. In this particular case, one of the committee chairs was not super fond of our bill, in part because they viewed the bill as a referendum on the broader House leadership, which was supportive of the bill. Speaker Scott Sikey was very supportive of our bill, and one of the committee chairs was not as supportive of the bill. And that threatened to derail the whole bill. But fortunately, we were able to sort of route the bill around that committee chair and get it through that hearing in the House.
Yeah, what went into making that possible? Because it seems like there are so many like points in this process where one troublesome legislator, let alone leader, like a committee chair, could stand in the way. And how did you get someone from being no and being opposed to leadership to being, I'll let it go through. If I'm not enthusiastic, at least I won't stand in the way.
I'll be honest, that's the sausage making that I'm not privy to as a member of the lay public. What I will say is we were fortunate to have a broad range of support from key legislative leaders in the state. And that starts in the US Senate with Senator Brian Schatz. It extends to the governor's office with Governor Josh Green, who has made housing his key policy priority. And it also goes into both of the houses in our state legislature. So our state house speaker Scott Sikey was very supportive of our bill. And in the state Senate, we had support both from the housing chair, Senator Stanley Chang, and also from the Senate President Ron Koichi. Hawaii is a state where in the both houses of the legislature, having sort of leadership support is crucial to getting bills through. And we were fortunate to have leadership support in both houses.
Yeah, I wonder what those back not backroom in any conspiratorial way, but wonder what those backroom conversations were like to make that happen.
Yeah, they don't invite me to those.
Yeah, I mean same, and I'm probably glad to sit on the outside of anything like that. I wouldn't be able to keep up. Let's talk about the legislative strategy, if you will, for a sec, because y'all ran a number of bills. And from my recollection, there was basically one bill that served as like a lightning rod that kind of attracted all the attention the ire, the good and the bad alike, and then other bills that are probably, it seems like, very consequential for land use in your state passed by much more easily.
Yeah, let me talk about the sort of below the radar bill first and then the lightning rod. So HB 2090, which allows for multifamily zoning in all commercially zoned areas, could potentially be the single most consequential bill in Hawaii state history. A lot depends on how the counties implement that bill. So, for example, pretty much all strip malls and malls are commercially zoned property in the state of Hawaii. If you add multifamily residential housing, depending on what that definition of multifamily housing is, you create the development potential for tens of thousands of units. As you know, right, strip malls have huge footprints, malls have huge footprints, and many of these older commercial centers, their activity has slowed, so they are ripe for redevelopment, but they often lack the zoning. And for an individual developer to have to go through that zoning process makes it difficult. But if you blanket rezoned all commercial property in the state of Hawaii and you allowed for dense multifamily and mixed use housing, the transformative effect is huge. It's tens of thousands of units. And it's tens of thousands of exactly the kind of units we want, right? These sort of mixed use, building housing near commercial centers, neighborhoods. That bill attracted no attention. There was pretty much no testimony in opposition to it. There was no news coverage of it at all. And the reason there was no coverage was SB 3202 sucked all of the air out of the room. Essentially, there was news coverage every week of people freaking out about adding accessory dwelling units to their neighborhoods. And it was all of the typical NIMBY concerns. This is going to add traffic. What about parking? And that dominated the news cycle. So, at the time, we were sort of dismayed and frustrated with all of the opposition to this bill, which we thought was very reasonable. In retrospect, though, it seems like that was helpful to the overall cause. Because while everyone was focusing on this very divisive lightning rod issue, we were able to pass bills that I think are potentially more transformative and will do a ton of good in the long term for Hawaii.
The 3202, the ADU bill, that originally started with more than ADUs in it, right?
Yeah, it had first it was going to allow three accessory dwelling units, so four units total. Which would have been more transformative. And the second thing it allowed was simplifying the process for small lot subdivision and allowing for subdivision to lots smaller than those currently permitted by the county.
Can you explain that to me? Because that gets real wonkish.
Yeah, so it's definitely wonky. The minimum lot size is a restriction that counties often set to define, the smallest possible residential lot you can have. So maybe it'll be 5,000 square feet. In Hawaii, some of the counties make it 6,000 square feet, like the county of Maui does. 6,000 square feet is a lot of land. And so it essentially says, this is sort of like the base for home ownership is can you buy 6,000 square feet of land? Unfortunately, in Hawaii, land costs are extraordinarily high because we have a finite supply of land and a lot of it can't be developed because it's on slopes. Or it doesn't have infrastructure. And so land costs in Hawaii are a significant portion of home ownership. So by having minimum lot sizes so large, you essentially limit home ownership only to people who can afford a lot of land. But worse than that, with various other development restrictions like setbacks, when you buy a 6,000 square foot plot of land, what you build on it is, like a house that takes up the middle of it, and then you have this huge lawn. And so you end up just wasting space. Many counties, including, say, like Houston, experimented with smaller lot sizes, even as small as 1,400 square feet. And 1,400 square feet allows you to build like a row house. And considerably lowers the barrier to entry, right? So for a 6,000, or let's say a 5,000 square foot plot of land, you could divide that into three 1,400 square foot lots. Each of those lots is more affordable. You can build a modest row house on it, and now you're a homeowner. And we looked at minimum lot size as a very important bill to help people transition from renting to homeownership. Because in Hawaii, on the housing ladder, there's this sort of gap in the middle where if you're renting, you can't quite save enough to buy, and the price of a single family home is too high. And we don't actually build a lot of more modest row houses or the type of housing that you see in places like Nashville or other cities that are growing while still making housing affordable. So unfortunately, that minimum lot size change was stripped out of the final version of the bill. But it is something that, the members of our coalition think is important to pursue in the future, because you just can't solve the housing crisis when your minimum lot size is 6,000 square feet, as it is on Maui.
No, 6,000 is really large. I don't remember. I think ours in Austin was, it might have been 5,000 or something. It was really, really large also. And then we recently, this year, lowered it to, I think, 1,500. And this is after watching, again, Houston, just a couple hundred miles east of Austin here, have a 1,400 square foot lot size. And I lived in Houston for grad school. I went to the University of Houston, the other UH. Y'all have a UH as well. And I remember being, Interloop Houston is surprisingly dense to people. They think of Houston as sprawly, but Interloop Houston is really spectacular, a variety of home types. And those row houses are popping up everywhere. And the cost of them is remarkably low compared to anything here in Austin. I think for those reasons you're talking about, I mean, there's scarce space. We don't have the scarcity of space like y'all do in the sense that we can, it seems like Texas runs on forever sometimes. But still, within the most desirable parts of town for folks, it's very scarce. And reducing that lot size and clawing away at some of the setbacks and stuff. You mentioned the setbacks, which is like the space from, I guess, the curb, however many feet deep into the lot that you can build. That makes a huge difference for those middle housing types, which I was sad that it wasn't included in the bill, but definitely it seems like that kind of lightning rod, then you had space to come back and pare it down and still make meaningful change, even in that bill, and then also allow the other things to move a little more easily. Is that your feeling?
Yes, and we're not done on minimum lot size, and we're not done on trying to address some of these other constraints that are preventing these missing middle housing typologies from succeeding in Hawaii. But it's probably a bridge too far to combine both. We're going to build a lot more ADUs, and we're going to reform minimum lot size. The other aspect there is a considerable bit of legislator education that needs to continue. Some people say in Hawaii, it's going to take you at least three tries to pass a major piece of legislation. Our ADU bill was highly unusual in that it went through on its first try, especially given how contentious it was. And that was actually a powerful signal that we wanted to send, is, given the scale and immediacy of the housing crisis in Hawaii, we can't do this, wait 3 years to pass policy, when, especially when we know the policy is common sense and logical, as it was with the ADUs, right? It restricting people to only building one ADU does not make sense if your goal is to solve the housing crisis. Making minimum lot sizes be 6,000 square feet does not make sense if your goal is to solve the housing crisis. These are common sense things that you can explain to, a college student in an hour. And so we just need to continue the public education and educating legislators so they understand why these issues are important and how their votes can help to resolve them.
Yeah, and thankfully they're pretty popularly supported when people have it explained, that broad support. I think there was some polling in Hawaii that we looked at that showed public support. I want to talk about the ADU thing for a sec because I think ADUs often evoke like a detached kind of back house shed garage thing. Your ADU bill includes attached units, right?
Yes.
Like attached to the main house.
And there's two primary things that are important there. The first is Hawaii does have a lot of multi-generational living. And so, some people prefer to have the attached ADU, like an in-law unit, an in-law suite. The other thing is the attached thing is also trying to address some of the subdivision of older homes. Hawaii has a rapidly aging population. And so in some cases, you have, grandma and grandpa, but their kids are gone, their grandkids are gone, and grandma and grandpa are living in a 3 or 4 bedroom house. So can you create a process where they can easily, subdivide that house into a duplex and then be able to legally rent out a portion of it? That process is not easy and straightforward. So allowing for attached ADUs helps to simplify that process where you can potentially divide houses like that.
I mean, the very extreme scarcity of housing and land in Hawaii seems to have led to some extra legal living arrangements that came up during the campaign, the whole like quote monster home thing. And this was kind of billed by opponents as something that was like they're trying to build more or legalize monster homes, but really it was kind of doing the opposite, right? You were daylighting that.
Yes. So a bit of background on monster homes. These are illegal homes. And the term monster home was coined by a local county council member to describe homes where builders were illegally building like 12 bedrooms and 5 bathrooms into the envelope of what was supposed to be like a single family home. And of course, these were being rented illegally, in a very inexpensive way. In defiance of local regulations on who can occupy a unit as a family, which is essentially 5 unrelated members is sort of your limit. These units were illegal and they generated a ton of negative press, and this has been going on for years prior to our bill. Opponents of our bill tried to do the sleight of hand of labeling what we wanted as monster homes, even though it was exactly the opposite. The homes that we want to build are perfectly legal. They're definitely not 10 bedrooms, and it was just a dirty trick by opponents of the bill to try to attach it to something that in Hawaii has a very negative connotation. I mean, monster homes don't sound good anywhere, right? But to your point, the only reason we have monster homes is because of a dire shortage of really affordable housing types. In particular, you're missing middle housing typologies, which are more affordable. And then another type, single room occupancy, which used to be common in Hawaii, but just like in the broader United States at a certain point, was either explicitly banned or fell out of favor, and so doesn't exist. If I can, I'd briefly like to touch on the Kauhale projects that are being built in Hawaii. Kauhale sort of roughly translates to village, but essentially, to address the homelessness issue in Hawaii, the governor has been pushing a Kauhale model, which are single room occupancy, very small, 100 square foot bedrooms with centralized kitchen and bath facilities. And these units can be built very inexpensively, sometimes as low as $50,000 a unit, which is very affordable, and then rented, for an indefinite period of time to homeless people or to people on very low fixed incomes, and creating a housing type that's really inexpensive. The reason that monster homes exist is because we made single room occupancy illegal. The only way the governor's been able to build these SROs is through emergency proclamation that bypasses all of the applicable county and state laws. And so part of the solution to make housing affordable is just to legalize affordable housing. Missing middle housing is affordable housing. Single room occupancy is affordable housing. Hawaii, in a lot of cases, makes both of those housing types illegal. And as a consequence, we don't have affordable housing.
Yeah, and y'all are not alone in that for sure. I mean, I thinking about those types of housing, when I was coming out of college, I didn't have but maybe a penny to my name on a good day, and it was like that kind of thing could have been transformative for me to get my footing And there's nothing like that here either, really. I mean, it reminds you of like a hostel, which you can, vacation and do in some places. I stayed in a hostel in LA. And I'm like, at 22, I had a degree in geography and I was trying to figure out what I was doing with my life. That would have made things a lot easier, kept me better fed and housed with much less precarity.
Yeah, and SROs are still common across Europe, across Asia. It's really just the United States that decided that we were going to make these completely illegal. And, there are valid reasons why SROs might not be appropriate for certain people, but for, say, like young single men, SROs are entirely appropriate. And so making a whole type of housing illegal, in my opinion, is just not a good idea. So those are the things that we're working against in Hawaii, right? Is how do you enable these typologies that are currently illegal?
Let's talk about how you make this happen then outside of the legislature, because the grassroots component of this is consequential, I'm sure. People have strong feelings everywhere about housing types. And when you have like scare words like monster homes being floated around, even if illicitly, that can agitate. So how did y'all prepare for that on the like the media and grassroots side?
For Housing Hawaii's future, we started proactive outreach to what we call in Hawaii our neighborhood board system. So on Oahu, which contains the county of Honolulu, about a million people, there are 33 neighborhood boards. And so they essentially meet once a month, and it's representatives from the neighborhood who express their concerns to county and state officials and discuss, overgrown grass on the medians or issues that are happening in the public park. And we did a campaign, Housing Hawaii's Future did, where we went to 31 of the 33 neighborhood boards to start talking about our organization and housing policy, building relationships with members on these boards. When it comes time for the campaign, much of the discussion of these bills happened at the neighborhood board level. And unfortunately, many of the Oahu neighborhood boards wrote letters and passed resolutions expressing their opposition to SB 3202. In our opinion, though, we just have to continue that proactive outreach to these organizations, trying to help them to understand these issues. The NIMBY sentiment is always going to be high in things like neighborhood boards. So we sort of view it as you can't persuade everybody. There are people on the extremes of either end of a policy who will never change their minds, but there is this sort of like reasonable middle. And so our thought process is let's go to the neighborhood boards. Let's share about Housing Hawaii's future. Let's share about how we can address our housing crisis. Some of the hardliners are going to say, no, not in my backyard. But many of the people in the middle will say, oh, that's reasonable. And if you can just persuade enough of those reasonable people in the middle, you can pass your policy. And I think Hawaii is a case in point of that. SB 3202 passed on a slim but reasonable margin in terms of votes, even though it generated considerable negative sentiment and opposition, because we just had reasonable people in the middle who said, no, this actually is a good idea. And we're going to do it anyway, even if people are upset about it.
That was a bipartisan split, wasn't it? That made it cross.
Yeah, well, it didn't break cleanly along party lines or along factional lines within the legislature. There was one general trend, though, which is the neighbor islands pretty much overwhelmingly supported the bill, whereas there was a split on Oahu between rural Oahu, which generally supported the bill, hyper-urban Honolulu, which generally supported the bill, and then the what I call the inner ring suburbs of Honolulu, which opposed the bill in full force. Essentially, these suburbs were built, 50, 60 years ago. At the time that they were built, it was like greenfield. There wasn't much there, and these suburbs were built up, and the people there bought their homes with the understanding that nothing would ever change and they would forever be suburbs. Unfortunately, in like 60 years, the city of Honolulu continued to expand. And so those suburbs have to densify, as happens when cities normally grow. So just like in other municipalities and states across the country, the biggest resistance to adding density comes from these sort of suburbs that said, we're not going to change, right? Why don't you go build somewhere else? The problem in Hawaii is there, in many cases, isn't a somewhere else to build. You can't just expand out forever. And the other problem we have is our traffic management is very poor in Hawaii. And so some of these sort of, I guess you'd call them exurbs or, beyond the suburbs. At this point, those people have to drive like an hour and a half to get to the urban centers. And that's one way, and oftentimes traffic can make that even worse. So, it's just unsustainable at the point where people are spending 3 hours a day driving to and from work. You really can't push people any further than that without hitting a breaking point. So, despite the resistance of those inner ring suburbs of Honolulu, we were able to pass the bill.
I remember some of that kind of ferocious opposition from those inner ring suburbs. Y'all, in addition to just the ideological diversity of your coalition, between Hawaii Appleseed, Hawaii MB, Housing Hawaii's Future with you, Grassroot, you also seem to have a variety of technical expertise, like ability to apply weight in different directions. I know, for example, Grassroot did quite a bit of digital work. Y'all have kind of cornered the younger activist kind of core there. Obviously, like AARP and those kind of groups are focusing on different demographics as well. Was that by design or chance? And how much influence did that have, do you think?
It was by divine providence. So we were really lucky. Hawaii Yimby was led by Damian Waikoloa and Matt Popovich. Matt Popovich just happened to be a software engineer with a background in political campaigns. And so that's really helpful. Damian was fantastic in terms of organizing grassroots support, getting people out to testify. Trey Gordner, who led the Hawaii Zoning Atlas, has a master's in planning and also understood zoning on an intimate level because he led the team that built the Hawaii Zoning Atlas. So he could speak on a granular level about how these bills would impact county zoning. He was probably the state's leading expert on county zoning, actually. People from the Grassroot Institute, right, they had tremendous technical capabilities in terms of using platforms to debate supporters for testimony. And then, having policy expertise from the Senator Brian Schatz's office, really helpful as well. So, Arjuna Haim, from Hawaii Appleseed as well. Hawaii Appleseed, it's a progressive think tank that has for years been working on housing policy. And so they're a well-regarded source for housing policy. So having their endorsement of the policy was useful. They also convene a separate coalition called the Hawaii Housing Affordability Coalition. And that coalition also came out in support of the bill. And that wouldn't have happened without Appleseed support. So, it was just very fortuitous that all of these forces came together and were able to be convened with a group like Holomua Collaborative, which brought together these sort of activist grassroots groups and connected them with some of the more grasstops leaders of businesses, leaders within the public sector, leaders within the nonprofit and labor communities. And bringing all of that together, the technical expertise with business and community leaders, really made the difference at the end of the day.
It was a remarkable team effort there. Well, we're coming up quick on our time, so I just want to open it up if there's anything else that you think people should know from the work you've done in Hawaii. I would love to make that space.
We're grateful, obviously, for champions like Representative Luke Ebslin and Senator Stanley Chang, and obviously our Governor Green and Senator Brian Schatz, who've been tremendous supporters of housing, and our leadership in both the House and the Senate Speaker Scott Cyke and Senate President Ron Cochie. At the end of the day, I think our experience illustrates the power of building robust coalitions. Our coalition, we have a group chat going and we're still talking pretty much every day. Building a really cohesive and ideally diverse core can really help to advance your policy because it gives you so many more resources to draw on when you get into tough times. The other thing I'd say is, be bold. When we came up with this policy, three accessory dwelling units, there were lots of people who were like, it's too bold, it's too crazy, there's no way it will happen. At the end of the day, our housing policies were the most significant statewide zoning reform in the last 40 years since like 1981 in Hawaii. And at least when we talked with other YIMBY Action affiliates and members of the Welcoming Neighbors Network, it was one of the most significant state level housing actions in the entire country last year. So if you build that coalition, you can hit singles, but you should also swing for the fences. Sometimes if you swing for the fences, you bat signals while you go. Other bills that were passed, like HB 2090, had a transformative effect, and we still got this big, bold lightning rod policy through. So we're going to continue to push in Hawaii and try to make progress. And we look forward to collaborating with folks from the Welcoming Neighbors Network, folks from YIMBY Action, folks all across the country who are working on this housing issue and try to chip away at it bit by bit.
It's exciting work, and it's amazing what you did, even just in the first go around. So I'm super excited to see what happens in round two and three and on. Hopefully, some minimum lot size stuff,
Fingers crossed.
right? Well, Sterling, always such a pleasure to learn from you. I'm so grateful to work with you, have been since we first got to meet each other early on in my time at Welcoming Neighbors, and grateful for your time on the podcast. I think there's lots of good stuff here that people can take home with them. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Cutter.
Sterling's fighting the good fight in Hawaii, and it was such a privilege to talk to him about his work on our show. With Sterling and his coalition doing the work, you can bet we'll be hearing more about big wins in Hawaii very soon. And until then, you can find Housing Hawaii's Future on social media at Hawaii's Future, that's HAWAIIS FUTURE, and online at hawaiisfuture.org. You can also find Sterling on social media at Sterling Iga, that's STERLINGHIGA. As always, you can connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are WNN Pro Housing on Instagram and Twitter, and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. The Stoop is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez. The music for the show was produced by my dear friend, Nolan Hopkins. And if you have ideas for our show, including special episodes, guests you'd like to hear from, or topics you'd like to cover, just shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us or DM me on social media. My handle is at CutterWGonzalez. That's CutterWGonzalez, not S, across all platforms. Thanks so much for joining us. Talk to y'all real soon.